Peace and love, everybody. It's your girl, Melanie Charles, a.k.a. D-Flower. Thank you so much for tuning in to this special Make Jazz Chill Again episode, where we'll be spotlighting the work of legendary, multidisciplinary artist, composer, performer, Meredith Monk. Meredith Monk is one of those artists that has really pushed the limits when it comes to the way in which we experience music, and the way in which we use the voice, a technique that she calls the extended technique, where she explores creating without the use of lyrics. Y'all, Meredith Monk has been super inspirational to me in my process. And if you dive into her work, you might see, this is where lots of your faves have drawn their inspiration. On this episode, I'm joined by my good friend, Lorraine, an incredible artist that is killing the streets right now. Everyone is talking about Lorraine. Everyone's talking about her first self-titled album, Lorraine. And of course, her latest release, I Killed Your Dog. She's about to go on tour. And on this episode, we get to talk a little bit about her and her process, but really with a lens of celebrating and spotlighting Meredith Monk, an artist that has really paved the way for those of us who are really creating art in a different type of way, if you will. Hopefully in this episode, you are inspired and intrigued by the idea of this Meredith Monk woman. Hopefully you go on YouTube and dive into her works. My favorite is the Turtle Dreams, but also I really love 16 millimeter earrings as a really close second when it comes to her combination of visuals and imagery and movement and sound. Y'all, she just has created all these different worlds, and I'm really excited for you guys to tap into that. And those of you who got it like that, if you're inspired to support the House Foundation, which the mission of the House Foundation is to archive and gather her art, her legacy. She's still here with us. She's still kicking it. She's still making new art. She ain't going nowhere. But now is the time to really rally around this important artist and make sure that the next generation is hip to this work. So thank you so much, everyone, for listening to the Make Jazz Chill Again podcast throughout these past, 2 years now. It really means a lot knowing that you guys are enjoying this offering, and we're really excited to be bringing you more information, more music, more ideas, more conversations, more Trill Mega Jams, and just remember to keep it Trill. Signing out. Enjoy this special episode. Peace. Peace and love, y'all. It's your girl, Melanie Charles, a.k.a. D-Flower, and you are listening to the Make Jazz Chill Again podcast. I hope you guys are feeling good today. You might be wondering, where's Uni? We only hear Melanie's voice. Well, my co-host Uni is on a much-needed self-care break, leave of absence, and she'll be back with us for the next episode. So today you got me. Well, not just me, because I have a really, really, really cool special guest, an artist that I've admired for many years now. She's your fave's fave. And we're also going to be talking about our fave's fave as well on this episode. She goes by the artist name Lorraine, but those of you who are privileged to know her privately know her government. I don't know if you want the people to know your government on this episode. I'll let you give consent. But welcome to the podcast, Lorraine!
Wow, that's the best intro I've ever gotten, Melanie.
Thank you so much for making time for this today, because I know you mad busy and you be doing mad stuff. So thanks for being here.
Of course, anything for you, Melanie.
So can I say, if I slip up and say your government, is that okay?
Yes,
like, I feel like before you were very like under, you really didn't want people to know, but now I notice you kind of opened it up a bit.
I'm more open now. It's true. I appreciate you asking.
So I guess, you know, today's episode. Well, okay, let me backtrack. Taja and I are both on the board of trustees for the Meredith Monk Foundation, which preserves and educates and archives the work of legendary artist Meredith Monk. And there's an event happening in a few weeks, and we just want to talk about her art and why. Maybe you might want to check out this event and support the movement. But before we get into that, I always wanted to get you on this pod and talk about you, Taja, and your artistry. Something that I'm really proud about, like I brag about this all the time, is like one of the first Lorraine performances. I was blessed to be part of the band. Your music has you avoid categories and boxes in a way that I really admire. That's what I seek to do. I feel like you figured it out though. Like nobody can put you in a box, and I love that. So yeah, like I don't know, like talk about your musical journey, because I feel like also you are doing a lot of like curation and like behind the scenes work to put art out, and then suddenly you dropped on the scene and was like, yo, I'm an artist, y'all. Maybe let's start from that, like your transfer over to really walking in your artistry.
Yeah. Well, firstly, thank you, Melanie. That's always something I brag about. I'm like, did you know the Melanie Charles played in Lorraine? Yeah, I mean, you know, I never really thought of myself as a musician. You know, I didn't think it was like something that was possible to do. And so I was just kind of making music in private for a long time. And playing shows sometimes, but I didn't really feel like I had much of a musical community. And as I slowly started finding that, you're also a big part of that journey too, Melanie. You know, I feel like I started to step into my artistry a little bit more. But yeah, I was very shy about it. was working at art institutions and really just kind of keeping my lives separate. And I started noticing that people would like, you know, they'd write to me and they'd be like, we want to invite Lorraine to do this thing, and not realize it was me.
Oh, wow.
So I like really was living this double life where, no one could tell who Taja was and who Lorraine was, like in a full sense.
I wonder what was it that made you feel like, oh, even though you have always been, I believe you were born an artist, you know, even though maybe you weren't actively pursuing or something, what do you think it was that made you feel like, nah, but I'm not really? And then like what made it click for you to be like, okay, yeah.
Yeah, I guess, I don't know. It's something about school. I feel like I was like wrapped up in that, and like what sort of training I had or didn't have, and perceived limitations. Also my dog Icon might come say hi, because he's
Yes, please.
Be involved in the conversation.
As an icon would.
As an icon would. But yeah, I think it's just that. It's like really just perceived limitations, and also just not really seeing models of someone that had my particular journey, and not expecting much from the industry, and being like, how can someone like me making the music that I'm making do anything? I just hadn't seen it. And then I think I got to a point where I was like, I'm just going to do it anyway and just kind of make what I make. And, you know, wasn't expecting anybody to listen, really. I was just like, I'm making it for myself because this is all I know how to do.
And I think like whenever those artists that are listening might agree that it's like, it's those moments when you're like, this is for me, is when you really make your best work. The other day I was on a panel with Ben Ratliff, the critic, and he's like an educator and, you know, a writer in the arts. You know, we all feel ways about, you know, critics and people who write in the art space. But I actually really appreciated something that he said when he said that music oftentimes isn't really about the music itself, but it's about the relationship surrounding it and like the ideas around it. And so when you say that people are hitting you up, like they're like, oh, we want to see Lorraine, and you're like, oh, that's me. It's like they want your like what you have to say, you know. And I feel like with your first album, what you were saying was just so like needed in that time. Like there were so many like brown skin girls, like weird brown skin girls that are into different shit, that like
you were that representation for them. Like, you speak about, like, oh, you didn't see that. So you were like, oh, where do I fit in that? Like, I feel like you have really paved the way for non-traditional, you know, artists to be like, okay, there is a space for this. Girl, when I tell you, you have like a cult following, like people like be like, oh my God, I'm such a fan. Oh my God. Like all over the world, like all kinds of festivals, wherever I'm performing, like your name does really come up. So I think kudos to you and like thank you for the work that you've done. So since then, we're talking about that first album, but since then you've been three albums deep. The last one, I Killed Your Dog. What, like, when did you get Icon? Did you come up with that title while you had Icon? How does Icon feel about this?
Icon does not like it, and he feels a lot of ways about it. But the title really comes from just thinking about breakups and relationships, and thinking about what it feels like to hurt the people that you're close to. And I love dogs so much, and I noticed that dogs were coming up in my lyrics, and so I wanted the title to really kind of feel a little bit like that hurt that I was describing on the record. But alongside that, I also had been wanting a dog so badly. And so the song came first, then came the record, and then I was like, you know what? I've been wanting a dog for years. I just need to do this. And in the song, there is a recording of my own doorbell, and he hates the doorbell. So whenever he hears us practicing or like referring to the song, he just like loses his mind because he's like, I can't hear this sound.
That is really funny. I love that. I guess like also like a lot of your work, you explore like grief in there and in such a like beautiful medicinal way. I really appreciate that. And like the themes sort of seem to be consistent, and in a way that you develop like a trust for your listeners. So like they know that they can come to you for this medicine, you know? So pivoting over to, you know, Meredith, I see a lot of parallels, you know, in her work. And, you know, part of this episode, I do want to like educate the people a little bit about Meredith Monk, if y'all aren't Meredith Monk fans already. So I'm going to read a little bit about Meredith. She's a New Yorker, born in 1942. She's a composer, singer, director, choreographer, creator of new opera, musical theater works, films, and installations. And she's a pioneer in what is now called extended vocal technique and in interdisciplinary performance. So basically, she explores singing, but oftentimes without lyrics, and just exploring vowels and syllables and like how that works together to really make you feel something. And I gotta say, the first time I saw her live, I was in tears because I never experienced anything like that. Over the last 6 decades, she's been hailed as a magician of the voice and one of America's coolest composers. She's got so many awards and honors, but the one that I like is in 2015, our President Barack Obama gave her the National Medal of Arts, which is really cool. She went to Sarah Lawrence College and began creating work in galleries and churches and mostly non-traditional performance spaces. Like, she was about that life, even though now that's really popular about, you know, performances happening in non-traditional spaces. She was really a huge pioneer in that. Currently she's working on a piece right now. She's the girl is 81 years old. And she still is actively like creating new works. And that is also really, really inspiring to me. So I guess for you, Taja, what I would love to know is, what was your first encounter with Meredith's work?
Oh man, it's hard to remember my first encounter with her work, but I think I always just had a fascination with the voice, and I never, you know, studied formally or anything like that. And I think for me, what was really interesting to me was, you know, extended technique in that way. Just seeing like artists that could really stretch the boundaries of what the voice can do as an instrument. And I don't even remember how I found it, but I found Our Lady Fate, And I would listen to it every single day. Like literally every single day I'd wake up. That was like my routine. And I'm horrible with routines, but that was like the closest I'd come. Was listening to Meredith Monk every single day while I'm like brushing my teeth and like getting ready for the day. It was like she would greet me. And yeah, it was just such a guide for me as someone that didn't really know how to study the voice or felt like nervous about my relationship to the voice. I would use like that album in particular as like a way for me to explore my own voice. And so I would listen to it and I would like sing along with her and I would sing all of these pieces throughout the day. And yeah, it really helped me find a relationship to my own instrument. I've always felt so grateful to her for that. And also just, I think I probably encountered her in photographs and in video first because I was an intern at the kitchen. And I was in the archives and they were putting together an anniversary show. And so I spent lots of time in the archives and I learned about all of these iconic figures in the New York downtown scene and Meredith, of course, being one of them. And I remember probably encountered her first through that archive.
Shout out to the kitchen. I was just there for the first time last week on a panel surrounding the works of Harmony Holiday.
Yes.
yes, that's where I met Ben, and also Raoul Roach was there as well. Shout out to Harmony. What an incredible artist. I would say I put her in that similar pantheon of like artists that are just like breaking the boundaries and breaking all the rules in order to really like shake people up and wake them up. And I think like that's really what art could really be about when it's in its best form. I guess what I can say about my first encounter with Meredith's work was it was kind of late. I would say I found out about Meredith's work about 2 years before the pandemic. And it was due to a friend of mine named Sebastian Bremer. Hey, Sebastian, incredible visual artist. And he brought me in and Ignabu to come and do a duo set. That was back in the day when those of you who know, when Ignabu and I were doing a lot of duo things, and I performed, I had all my SPs and stuff, and he was like, "You remind me of Meredith Monk." And I was like, "Who?" And I went home and I Googled and I discovered Turtle's Dream.
Yes.
Shook me up. Changed my life. I was like, oh my gosh, wow. I think the thing that really first got me is her usage of space and time and how the work really slowly evolves and develops into finally what you see at the end. I really encourage everyone to go into the YouTubes and find this piece. It's music, it's film. And that was another thing for me, just seeing from what, do you know what year that was? I should have researched what year that piece came out. So progressive in terms of like performance art. I mean, or I guess I just didn't know. And you saying that you went through the archive at the kitchen, that downtown art scene is so rich. And I know that that's something that I need to dig deep into, because what we're discovering is that whether or not we know of these people's work, that they existed. And a lot of times when you think about artists that find fame or popularity, oftentimes it's those underground artists that were really pushing things that are really, and I think Harmony touches on that. It's like the unknown artists are the ones that we want to look to for like the amazing work that comes out in this world. So yeah, that was my Meredith encounter. I guess also what comes to mind is that she created The House, which is basically like a school to teach this extended technique. And I think that that's really important. I wonder, Taj, like, what are your thoughts about artists creating space for bringing people in, educating, creating a movement? Like, what does that mean to you? How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, lately I've been really understanding the generosity of that gesture, right? Like, how hard is it to be an artist to not only make the work, but to be a small business owner, really, and mm-hmm, to be mm-hmm. a leader. And, you know, you lead a band, you lead all kinds of, you've led lots of bands. Like, that's work. Mm-hmm. That's really hard work. And not only like musical work, but it's, lots of forms of care and labor that don't go, that, you know, if you're not intimately involved with it, you don't even know what that is. So on top of all of that, to maintain an artist practice, but to also find ways to give that back to other people is really wild. And I don't think I even fully understood like how important that is and also how generous that is until very recently. Just as my own practice has been developing, I really started to like think about this a lot, actually, and how how it's just how incredible that is.
Yeah, generous is definitely the word. I think it's a word that I'm always like using is capacity. Like, I find that my capacity gets like less and less, you know, in this life. And there's so many things going on. It's just like really, really hard. And I try to give myself grace. It's interesting because I think when I hit you up to do this episode, I felt the need to address that it is interesting us being two women of color on a board, you know, essentially supporting the work of a non-Black person. And like, part of our role is to raise awareness and educate about that work. But oftentimes, like, Black artists don't have that type of support. But I, like I said to you when we spoke earlier about that, is that I felt good in my role with Meredith, because Meredith has always been so, what's the perfect word? I guess mindful and aware of her role and maybe some of her privilege in the world. I remember during the pandemic, really, when you remember when everyone was all of a sudden aware about Black lives and like the crap that we go to, when everyone was like, oh, we do this. I reached out to Meredith because I was really grappling with, remember how all the artists were like, I have to make art about this, about the pandemic and what I'm going through. And like, I felt a little, clueless as to how I wanted to go about that. And something told me, call Meredith. And she was so generous with her time, with her advice, and also just really articulated how she could never really fully understand how I feel as a Black woman in this space. And I think that basically what I'm saying is Meredith is a true ally, and her work has always been centered around the voiceless, you know? Go figure, yeah. You know what I mean? What I'm also thinking about nowadays is like, how do we create this type of support? What Meredith has been able to gather, how do we do that for other artists, for the other OGs? Like, you know, I'm a huge Reggie Workman, like, disciple. You know, he's 86 years old. You know, he's worked with John Coltrane and like, that's like the biggest name that people say first, but like, he's kind of been part of every type of movement. He also was part of that kitchen scene that I'm finding out, you know? And so, you know, now he's 86. I don't think that he has the capacity to like start from point one to, let's say, develop a foundation or whatever. So now the responsibility falls on his mentees, his students. And that's really hard, as artists to then also say, but I kind of have a responsibility to be a part in conserving and archiving this work of my teacher? Like, where are you in that journey? How do you feel about that? Do you feel that kind of like responsibility? I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the work takes many forms. I feel like, you know, I think when we have conversations and we talk to each other, we're like, hey, how do we approach this thing? I'm really struggling with this. Like, how do you approach this artist? Like, that's a part of the work. Mm. I think when like young people DM me and they're like, hey, I don't know how to do this. How do I approach this? Or if people come to me at shows, that's a part of the work. And then also, you know, like also looking to elders and finding ways to support them. I haven't really had a teacher in that way, but I find myself also trying to figure out how to archive the work of Beverly Van Copeland and keep his work alive. Years in my life that I similarly am trying to figure out how to support and bring awareness to, and of course Meredith. So I think it's a responsibility that shows up in different ways and in many different directions and for many different people. And I think it's maybe more of an ethos of just like, okay, it's not just about me and my work, but how do I support people in the various communities that surround me and my work? And so it necessarily ends up taking lots of different forms.
Yes, yes. And I like the way you say that, how it takes different forms, because it's very easy to be like, it has to be this way. I have to do this. I have to like start a foundation. I have to do, you know, I have to, you know, open up a music school. But it really does look like many different things. And yes, I remember the work that you've done with Beverly Glenn Copeland, because it was because of you that I found out about their work. And I really love the resurgence that has happened, you know, during the past few years. I'm like, that's where it's at. Because as we're seeing, a lot of a great artist is a great artist to the day they die. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't end. And feeling supported and feeling like your work still has a great deal of worth into your later years of life, I think is really important. That's like what keeps you healthy and alive and vibrant.
Yes, totally. I mean, I think the industry also, at least the music industry, and like Meredith, of course, you know, is intertwined in so many different types of art making, as you pointed out. But I think in the music industry in particular, and also probably others too, there is no sense of there's no sense of longevity, right? It's like you're young, you like either have success when you're 24 or you'll never find it, or like that moment when you're like a baby is like the only moment that people care about. It's like when you are first making work, but like, it's just kind of crazy. What do you expect artists to do with the rest of their lives? Just sit there and twiddle their thumbs? So I feel like having models of artists who are able to sustain a career, that's just so important, especially women artists, especially Black artists for me. And there, you know, there aren't so many models because it's not built for sustainability. And so it feels like these things happen against all odds, kind of, which it shouldn't be. Like, I'm interested in what someone has to say after spending decades on their craft. Of course I do. What have you learned? How have you evolved? How have you changed? Like, that's a really interesting conversation, actually. And I wish that was more supported.
Yes, I love that. I think that I want to know more about that as well. And I don't know, maybe we can make space for more conversations like that. Maybe we need another podcast, maybe with Meredith, maybe with Beverly. But like, yes, like how do you not get jaded and stunted and not let how your art is being received affect the way you feel about the art?
Yeah.
Yo, because I'm not going to lie, I'm definitely jaded in my life. And I think, you know, you talk about maybe it was like music school for you that maybe gave you pause in the beginning to create. I am a student of music school. And I think that that's a big piece of why I've kind of been, there's still crap from school that I'm still trying to unlearn that maybe make me feel like I'm inadequate or I haven't achieved certain things yet in order for me to feel good in my artistry. And when you're an artist, oftentimes your artistry is a reflection of how you feel about you, unfortunately, you know? So
which being around so to hear, because like for me, I'm like, you know, I hear you sing and I hear you play and I'm like brought to tears. You know what I mean? Like I can't, like, that's, you know, it's really, yeah, it makes me really sad that these systems make people who are so incredible feel like they're not. Just make them feel like not like themselves, right? Like,
yeah. I mean, did you go to music school?
No, I didn't really. I mean, I studied piano at certain points of my life, but I didn't go to music school. And so for me, I'm like, well,
good
I don't have,
you. Well, the other
good for you. That's what I'm saying. You weren't cursed with the curse of school.
I have like, a different curse, like, I think, girl. Which is just like feeling like I don't have something or I don't have the knowledge or the tools or I'm not smart enough or I'm not whatever, you know?
So I feel like, the grass is always greener, maybe somehow.
I think that like when we talk about Beverly or Meredith or Reggie Workman, they all have, did I say Reggie Workman earlier or did I say Jerry Eastman? Because Jerry Eastman is another mentor of mine that I always say Jerry Eastman when I mean to say Reggie Workman. So for those of you who are listening closely, yes, check out Jerry Eastman as well. Important artist, doing important work out here. Oh my gosh, I lost where I was going with that. Oh, I think that the reason why they're able to still continue freely is because although maybe we might associate them with a genre or certain scenes might consider them a certain genre or a certain type of art, I think they've emancipated themselves from that. You know? And there maybe lies the freedom.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I make what I make in the ways that I make it. It's literally that. It's a sense of freedom. I had a huge aha moment when watching Summer of Soul and just watching all of those artists, you know, talking about what they were making. And like, I think in the imagination of music listeners, they're like, oh, this is quintessential R&B or this is quintessential soul music. But they're like, that's not how I think about myself, actually. That's not what my music is. Yeah, and that really, really spoke to me. And I think that's really important, I think. Like that sense of freedom, especially for Black artists, because we've been pigeonholed the most and we're like pushing culture forward and we're making experimental work, really. Like we are, we are experimenting. Like hip hop is the most experimental genre. Jazz is extremely experimental. Like everything, all of that is experimental music and we don't get that credit. Actually,
yeah,
and so for me, that's like the whole reason why I make the things that I make. And it's important to see who is given that freedom and how they're able to have that freedom.
It's a
beautiful thing, and to try to extend that to as many people as possible. Because I don't think people actually think in genres in that way. I think community convenes around genre sometimes, but people are complicated. They're messy. They listen to all kinds of things. They have lots of different influences. Yeah. We aren't, you know, just living in our own little silos. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's true, especially with the now, I mean, radio is still kind of a thing, but not in the way that it used to be, how it's like this jazz radio, R&B radio, you know, like how I feel like people are on Spotify and just like going through what they're like. They're not necessarily putting in a genre or I want to hear, maybe some people do, but you know, the streaming platforms and all of that have sort of, I think in all the crap that comes along with streaming platforms, how they take advantage of artists and all that. And if you want to look at the good things is that it's really aiding in this like genreless idea of it. It's like, if it's good, it's good. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And if it's something that's relevant, it's relevant. So I think when I was looking, I was doing a little, you know, Lorraine research, you know, I was like, what the streets are saying? What should be saying in interviews and stuff? You've kind of termed this coin songness.
Yeah, I don't even remember saying
what
this.
Is that?
I don't. I honestly don't even remember saying this, but I believe it.
You like, that's something I would say.
But yeah, I felt like, I don't know how you feel when you sit down to write songs, but sometimes I'm like, wow, this feels like really hard. And mm-hmm, like, it's a lot mm-hmm. of pressure to sit down and be like, I'm going to write a song. And so I coined this term, like approaching songness, apparently. That was more about just having a complete musical idea without having to feel like I'm chained to this idea of what a song is or isn't. I just get to get a thought out and I can create in the ways I need to without having to feel like, okay, now I need a chorus here or a verse here or whatever. It's just an idea that feels complete and can exist on its own terms.
I love that. And I think that if Meredith were here, she'd be like, yeah, I connect with that idea as well, because a lot of her music is like mantra based and it might just be like one sentence, even though, like I said earlier, her work is surrounding, you know, a big part of her work is surrounding removal of lyrics, but there are spaces and pieces that do. And in those works, it really is mantra based, and she does sort of challenge the idea of song form and all of that stuff. So artists who are listening to us, please, you know, do yourself a favor and dive into the catalog of Meredith Monk's work. It's very vast, and I really believe there's something for everyone in it. So, you know, as we're closing out, lastly, I really want to encourage you guys, if you have it or if you know someone that has it, to look into the work of the foundation. There is a gala happening on May 14th, and we'll be honoring and celebrating Anne Waldman, Henry Threadgill, and Bonnie Moranka. All really important artists, all in the spirit of at large raising money. Did I say those names right, Tasha?
Yes.
Raising money. Raising money for the foundation, which is committed to conserving the art, archiving the art, sustaining Meredith Monk while she's still on this earth, and also creating an archive that will live past that. Anything else you want to add about this important gala that's happening, Tasha?
Yeah, I guess I'll just say that, you know, fundraising is really difficult work and that it really kind of takes a community. It takes a village to, to support sustainability, to support artists. And that also it will be very fun.
It'll be very fun. There's different tiers for those who got it like that. There's like these really fancy ticket rates, but there are artist rates for, you know, for the people like me who ain't got it like that, but want to be part of the art. If you want to go to meredithmonk.org. Also, I'm performing. Yes. And I'm very excited about that.
I was waiting until you were going to say that. I didn't want to blow up your spot, but I was like, and also, you get to see too. I know. Bonnie Charles.
It's so funny. I feel like so like in service in this space that I forget that I'm also performing. But I'm excited about performing because I'm gonna let me go into my Meredith Monk and I'm gonna be free. I'm just gonna like do my thing, and I have new works that I want to do during that performance. So I'm really excited about what might come out performance wise. It's on a beautiful ship. When was the last time you was on a ship? You know what I'm saying?
Exactly. Exactly.
So it's in the Hudson, right? Is that, do you know?
I'm not sure where it's sailing,
where
actually.
That ship is docked. Yeah. Well, if you want to find out more about that, once again, I encourage you all to go to meredithmonk.org. I'll have information in my link. This podcast will also be existing somewhere in Meredith's Instagram website, so you'll be able to check back in on that. And we hope that we've turned you on to a new artist today. And if you were already hip to her, hopefully this little information aid inspires you to support the movement, to inspires you to check out the work even more. And a reminder that what I think is really beautiful about the foundation is that it's yes, it's surrounding Meredith's work, but it's also making space for so many artists, which is another thing that I really loved in our last meeting, how Meredith really honed in on the fact that she's really investing in like the next generation. She's excited that she's able to share space with people that are continuing on the work. And that's what it's about. So thank you everyone for listening to the Make Gestural Again podcast today. Thank you to my special, special, beautiful, amazing guests, Lorraine, Taja. You're about to go on tour.
Yes, right? Yes, I am.
You want to say a little bit about that? Where you going to be? Let the people know where to find you.
Well, we're playing a show at Bowery Ballroom with Brandon Lopez and Fred Moten, which is really wild and really amazing. And we're doing a short tour Northeast right before that. And we're also going to Asia. We're going to Shanghai, Guangzhou, Seoul, and Tokyo. Yeah.
So tap in. Do you have a website? Like, where do you put all of your information for people to see? Like, what's the best place to check it out?
Yes. I would say lorraine.info/tours.
All right. Yeah. Y'all, so check it out. You heard it here first. And we hope to see you out here in the streets. Oh, we have this little sign off that we do. So I'll say whatever you do. And then Taja, if you'll say remember to, and then together we'll say make jazz trill again.
Cool.
Are you down?
Yeah, of course. Of course.
So whatever you do,
remember to
make jazz trill again.
Yay.